Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com. My name is William English, and this week's guest is William Fowler, the British Film Institute's first dedicated curator of artists' moving image. Good afternoon, William. Thank you very much for coming in.
Hello there. Thanks for inviting me in.
That's okay. And basically, I suppose the reason for this visit is the issue of Bruce Lacy, the Bruce Lacy CD.
Yeah, Spacey Bruce Lacy.
Exactly. The Film Music and Improvisations, which came out this year.
Yes.
Issued by Johnny Trunk Records.
Mm.
And coincidentally, well, a couple of years ago now, the British Film Institute issued a DVD, or two DVDs, as one package of the films and rituals of Bruce Lacy. This track is, the track we're listening to is actually called, I think it's called From a Kissing Film, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. That's right.
Track 8, Kissing Film from the Spacey Bruce Lacy. And I noticed on the CD the tracks aren't dated as such, are they? Do you know when it dates from?
This would be, I believe, about 1970, either 4 or 5.
Right.
And it's the sound for a film, as you'd expect, which is a remake of an earlier piece that Bruce had made with his wife, Jill Bruce, in 1967, which was black and white and would have shown at Better Books, in fact, in the basement, so in the early days of the London Filmmakers Co-op scene.
Right.
And this is a colour remake from a few years later, where they have sort of quite glam type makeup on and very lurid bright lipstick.
Right.
And the two artists, Jill and Bruce, kiss together, and it's a sort of tight frame of just their lips.
Mm.
And they introduce food into their mouths along the way, so it's quite sort of visceral and bodily.
Right.
And the music that we heard would have been a tape cassette originally that would have been played along with the film when it was projected, yes.
Right.
Yeah. But it wouldn't have, my understanding is it wouldn't have been played with the original in 67.
Okay.
Mm.
Okay. What is your background, as it were? How did you get into artist film as such at the BFI?
Well, I suppose I often think of myself as an enthusiast first and foremost, which is not necessarily something you might talk about in a professional sphere, but I didn't study film or go to art school.
Oh.
But I was, you know, I used to go to the NFT and the ICA a lot in the 90s, and also the Horse Hospital.
Right.
And I started getting involved with my own film screenings, and I was seeing a lot of ethnographic film work at college.
So when you say your own film screenings, you make
Sorry,
films?
Not my own. I was like, putting
oh, your own
on
screenings.
Things.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was putting
right.
films on,
yeah.
And I volunteered at the Lux, kind of almost when the Lux first started in its current guise, so
okay.
as an agency and distributor rather than as a cinema, primarily.
So that was up at Shacklewell Lane?
Yeah, so
right.
at Shacklewell Lane. So I think I was one of their first official interns.
Okay.
So I became quite immersed in the experimental sphere, sort of partially through that, but also having gone to see lots of work at the Lux Centre. So, you know, I remember going to see nearly everything in the Michael Snow retrospective they had on there in
right.
whatever year that would have been.
Mm.
And I had quite a, I suppose maybe I'm a romantic and a bit of a fetishist as well, so I was always very drawn to the actual film material.
Right.
Having done some voluntary work at what was the Huntley Film Archive.
Uh-huh. Huntley?
So it's a commercial film archive, predominantly 16mm. I mean, you often see their name at the end of a lot of television programmes and some feature films.
Right.
And they had all sorts of different things. And I got quite excited about just seeing quite different types of films having a sort of equivalence or equality within the archive. So, you know, the idea of canons and films being good or not so good sort of disappearing once you put all the films in a bit of storage space. They just become sort of objects. And that
right.
I found that kind of quite interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I trained to be a film archivist and then also having done this work at Lux.
So you set out to be an archivist or a curator? Or
I set out to be an archivist. So,
okay.
I've sort of joked I always thought I'd be a backroom boy,
yeah.
and then sort of as time has gone on at the BFI, I've become more and more sort of out front introducing screenings and talking with people. So you
started, it sounds like you were an independent sort of curator or enthusiast.
Yeah, I mean, I never would have called myself a curator at that point. I don't know, what I would have, enthusiast stroke programmer, maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you applied to the British Film Institute.
Having done this film archiving MA at the University of East Anglia.
Had they then created this position of an artist's film curator, or did you, you know, how did that come about?
No, yeah, they'd created the position, and it was initially co-funded by the Arts Council, so it had been sort of quite thought out.
Right.
And it was really to address the fact that the British Film Institute had never really concentrated on the artist film and experimental film area in a sort of very sustained way. I mean, sort of previously, people who'd worked at the archive at the BFI had an interest, and works had come into the collection, so it wasn't as if it was entirely absent, but there'd never been anyone who was kind of constantly looking after that work and thinking about things that weren't there and thinking about screening. So it was a move to acknowledge that that hadn't happened before and the era needed attention.
Yeah. And was there a distinction at that time? Did they make a distinction between, say, experimental and avant-garde film and artist's film? Or was it, are the edges still kind of blurred in that?
Well, it's interesting. I've been talking a lot about this recently. I mean, for a while, I've sort of thought, generally speaking, lots of people collapse everything into this, into artist moving image. And then the more conversations I have again recently, it seems to be that people want to map out the differences a little more, which is certainly, that's, you know, which interests me. I mean, my job title is curator of artist moving image, which I think is quite a mouthful apart from anything else, but I don't know, they do have different histories and, you know, the different types of works and effects on how you might talk about them and how they're presented. And during the experimental at London Film Festival, it was something that came up quite a lot. And it was, you know, this maybe it reflects what I'm just saying, but the term artist moving image actually perhaps having arisen through funding structures in this country. And this sort of slightly more blanket term, if you like, wasn't so prevalent in countries abroad, and this is quite a sort of British phenomenon, if you like.
Yeah.
Which is sort of interesting because, you know, for some people, I think they think of London and the UK as sort of currently either leading the field or being very visible internationally in terms of artists and experimental film.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the one of the issues with artists' film is that it often requires a different kind of space, doesn't it? It's not it doesn't always conform to the regular cinema space.
Mm.
I mean, does that come up as an issue at the British Film Institute? Is there any move to maybe create a space that's more sympathetic to...
There had been the gallery. I mean, about the same time I started, that there was also a gallery curator, and we started about the same time, and the first person was Michael Connor.
Is that the space behind the library?
Yeah, well, it's basically what the library is.
Right.
So that's where it was happening.
Yes.
And then Elisabetta Fabrizi took the position a little later after Michael Connor. So there was, at that point, a space to kind of explore...
Right.
The histories in that way and the relationship between the gallery and the cinema.
With different kinds of projection and stuff.
Yeah, and different artists. And
right. So is that restricting it in any sense at the moment, the fact that there isn't a gallery space?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's... I can speak about myself or I can speak about it, it's sort of institutionally, and then maybe just how the world sees things. I mean, my interest often lies in the fact that how have artists and experimental filmmakers sought to work within the confines of the cinema. So the fact that, you know, people come in at a certain time, the program is maybe lasting a certain length, it is predominantly single screen, you know, the projection is set up in a certain way. I mean, I think all those limitations, I'm kind of always curious about how people have explored those limitations and how they've been able to work around them or what they've chosen to focus on. So the fact that work can be, you know, there's this quite particular context in which work is seen, and yet the work itself can vary so enormously is quite interesting, I think.
Right.
But that's a sort of personal interest. I mean, I suppose I come from more of a film background than an art background, say, so I'm perhaps drawn in that direction.
Yeah. But presumably you're always restricted or confined to the single screen projection at the moment.
Yes, though we have done some expanded screenings. There's the projectionist can be very up for doing something a bit more unusual, and you know, there's a, you know, the BFI is rightly set up to try and embrace different types of work, and so, you know, with a bit of effort it can be possible to do other things. So so we did a double screen projection event in NFT One, the biggest cinema screen, about 3 or 4 years ago now. So we did a sort of general selection of works, you know, so James Scott, Sally Potter, an early Sally Potter piece, a few artists, and then we did a little focus on Malcolm McGuire and Paul Sharratt's. And it was a double 16mm projection in NFT One, and basically the screen opening up to the CinemaScope ratio, if you like, and then the two 16mm images running at the same time. It was really pretty extraordinary. So these things require time and effort, but it's not impossible.
Right. Okay, well, that's perhaps that brings us to Bruce Lacey then. And what's your connection with, do you have a particular connection with Bruce Lacey? Is it that you're mentioned on the notes of the CD?
Yes.
And also mentioned in the notes of the DVD?
Yes.
So you sound like an enthusiast for Bruce Lacey.
Yes, well, he was someone I spoke to quite early on when I started at the BFI. Maybe I should say that Lux had been involved with a project called Shoot, 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 restoring a number of works from the London Filmmakers Co-op from 1966 to 1976, which toured internationally. Yeah. And I was sort of working that a little bit when I was interning or volunteering at Lux. And I think when I came to BFI, I felt like, well, what other things were going on? You know, what artists were practicing outside of the co-op structure? Partly just because so much focus had just been given to that area. And then also quite a number of works had been restored from that time, or rather into negatives and new prints made. So, and then there was also the relationship with the Lux, who looked after a lot of those filmmakers. So it was sort of, I was both sort of practical and for interest's sake, I was drawn to think about what else was kind of going on outside that immediate context. So anyway, so Bruce Lacey was one of the people I was sort of starting to learn about, and the fact that he had been making films since 1952, he was at the Royal College of Art, so he sort of predated the kind of underground or counterculture scene, if you like, which you might argue initially was more influenced by an American sort of approach.
Right.
And his work was much before that. So he's based in Norfolk, and I got in touch, and it just initially spoke to him about him depositing his film material, negatives and other elements that he'd just been looking after in his house for decades. So, I think he made a film with the Arts Council called The Lacey Rituals, which would have had sort of obviously had an institutional connection, but most of the works hadn't entered into any archives or collection, so he just had this body of work in his house. Seemed like that was something that really needed taken care of and some interest put into it. And you know, and he was, although at that point he had perhaps been slightly forgotten by a lot of people, he was a well-known figure in the art scene in the 70s, but also before that. You know, he was on television a lot, he was involved with putting records out. I mean, these are all things perhaps we can talk about over the course of the program, but it's always quite interesting when you have people who are within certain milieus really, really well known, and then over time get forgotten for whatever reason. Anyway, so fast forward a few years, I'd always thought it would be great to do something a little, we did a couple of screenings when the work came into the archive, and then later I always thought there was something kind of quite unusual and interesting about his films, and it would be good to do something a little bit more sustained. And I've been in touch with Jeremy Deller, the Turner Prize winner, and he was also really interested in Bruce Lacey, and he and Nick Abrahams, the two of them, were planning to make a documentary film about him. And Jeremy Deller had also been talking with the Camden Arts Centre about doing a show of Bruce's work. So it just sort of, at that point, it seemed like, okay, well, this is obviously a good time to start thinking about his film career and do something a little larger. So there's the Lacey Rituals BFI DVD collection, but we also made 35mm blow-up prints of, I think it's 5 of his films, dating from Head in Shadow, his first, from 1952, up to the Lacey Rituals, as I mentioned, from later on. So we did some film preservation work, and also did the DVD and did the season. And there was a small touring program as well. So I think
who decides that one particular filmmaker is worthy of restoration, as it were? Is it like a committee meeting and says it's time we did something with Bruce Lacey's films? You know, he's a forgotten pioneer or something.
Well,
overlooked pioneer.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's comes out of a discussion with the senior and head curators of the archive. But often, I think, because of you know, the BFI is public funded, so often it's a sort of strange situation, but as well as having a preservation angle, there needs to be a kind of coherent way of actually presenting the work as well. So you, although the preservation side, you're thinking about how this work is going to be looked after for 100 years or so, at that particular moment there's a lot of pressure to make the work visible in a particular way. So that kind of timeliness of making something visible ends up being part of the equation. And also, I mean, the BFI has the Master Film Store, which holds films at minus 5 degrees, 33 relative percent humidity, which significantly slows down the decay of film stock. So preservation is important, and I think it's really important to have new polyester film elements created, but there is perhaps, you would argue that there is less need for preservation in the way there would have been sort of 10, 20 years ago because of, you know, this kind of basically the improvements in storage, so and the amount of film that is created, you know, or has been created as well. So,
I suppose, I mean,
I don't know if that answers your question.
Probably a lot of people who won't know who Bruce Lacey is. He was born in 1927, so he's something of a veteran, shall we say. He's been around quite a long time, and as you say, his early work really predates what one might call the sort of the recognised avant-garde films in this country.
In the post-war.
It seems he was, he's, by any accounts, he's what might be called an eccentric. Can we agree on that?
Yeah, I think, he did actually feature on a TV programme called David Allen's Great Search for David Allen's Search for the Great British Eccentric,
right? Okay,
which included him and Ivor Cutler and a few other people.
Yeah, I mean, for people that have never seen the films or heard the music, I mean, is the one? Can you think of one example that kind of maybe personifies what he's about? I mean, the rituals are pretty extraordinary, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, let me think.
He's described, or he described himself as, what his activities it took him a while to realise that what he was doing was performance art.
Yeah.
So he sort of started in, 1948 or something?
Well, I think when you look at he put together quite a comprehensive CV when he had a solo show at the Whitechapel in 1975. And at the time, he used this term event, so which I suppose is maybe, might be considered a happening or a performance, but so that, you know, when he was at the Royal College, he talks about how he dressed up as the Invisible Man, or maybe no, as an Egyptian mummy, and like wrapped all these kind of bandages around himself, and then just went off for a walk around Kensington. And this would have been in like the early, it'd be a bit later, 53-54, which probably would have been quite an unusual sight. I mean, sometimes I think of, you know, these semi-confrontational, playful performances as being maybe a sort of English equivalent of the Vienna Actionist or something. And that may sound absolutely absurd, but I think in terms of the time period and the things that they were reacting to, and to a degree what, but like Bruce Lacey and other artists from that time reacted to, I think there is a connection. So Bruce Lacey had been in national service prior to art school. He was very aware of you know, the politics of the British Empire. He'd had TB. You know, he'd been through a lot of trauma as a young man, and he became interested in art, making art as a means of sort of recovering from that trauma.
And that
and addressing
that
the politics
of that
time
of self-healing and sort of psychotherapy runs through all of his work. Actually,
yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I suppose he's what you might call a shaman. Is it? Is that?
I mean, maybe people who don't know his work, it's worth saying that, you know, there are these different phases to his creative life, and you know, in the '70s he became more accepted at some level by the art world, and then towards the end of the '70s became interested in, I don't know what you'd call it, sort of earth magic and the rhythms of the earth and kind of more natural materials. And he and Jill Bruce went all around England visiting stone circles and Neolithic monuments, documenting what they saw on Super 8 camera, kind of doing semi performances and events sometimes around the structures. And then they had a show at the Acme Gallery shortly after, which forget the name. Anyway, so there was kind of, you know, so he'd always had this sort of mystical performative element, you might say, but he began to embrace sort of ideas around shamanism, I suppose, and and earth rhythms, and I think much more overtly.
Yes, they're quite. I mean, they're quite extreme, aren't they? I mean, he's sort of. I mean, I did actually see. I saw one of his rituals in Reading. It was. I think it was on one afternoon. I think somebody like Ron Hazelden or somebody had organised a series of events, and Bruce Lacey went on in the afternoon. It was on a sort of compound within the campus of the university, and he basically erected like a teepee, or what might be called a wigwam.
Yeah.
And then there were sort of bones and feathers and all sorts of things laid out all over the ground.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be endless. There was no beginning, you know, it went on with lots of participants.
Yeah.
And him in a sort of costume, like a Native American costume, sort of chanting and banging a drum.
Yeah.
So, well, that no, but quite sort of
memorable,
but certainly memorable. I mean, he was certainly on his own, I think, with this kind of performance.
It's interesting. Can I just interrupt briefly? I mean, it's interesting. You know, you might think about how you think about someone's art practice, but you know, through the '70s, he was doing a lot of lecturing and visiting art schools around the country, as probably were a number of artists. But I think for him, those occasions were means of sort of confronting the status quo, even with an art school. So, you know, telling people to not listen to their tutors, and, you know, if they want to go off and do rock climbing, then they should do that. And that's, which you may think that's what people probably be told anyway, but I think he'd had a bad experience at art school and wanted to challenge even art schools themselves.
Yeah.
And it'd be a bit awkward and embarrassing maybe even in that situation. So anyway, so I think what you've described, and that was at an art school, wasn't it? Him, or did I miss hear what you said?
It was Reading. Yeah, I think it was the art school.
Yeah,
which I think was attached to the university. I honestly can't remember. I was living at Reading at the time, and it was all a bit vague. But
I think of these things as being part of his practice. Whether he would describe it like that, I'm not so sure. But But I heard briefly another anecdote of Jennifer Binney, who was part of the neo-naturist group in the early 80s. I think when she was at art school about the same time, it may have been the same occasion, I'm not sure. She was at Portsmouth, I think, so that was a similar time. And how Bruce Lacey and Jill Bruce did a performance, but they would only do their performances on grass, on actual, it's kind of natural landscape, so within the structure of a built-up art school, they had to find some area where there was a tiny little bit of grass. And on this occasion, it was very, very small, so they had to sort of work within very limited confines.
Right. So. But if we go back, the first film, I think, certainly the first film on the DVDs, is it's described. It says 1951. Head in Shadow.
Yes.
Which is about, I think it's about 20 minutes long.
Yes.
Possibly 30, 20 minutes. Black and white, sort of presumably 16mm.
Mm.
And he made them. I think his first few films were made with someone called John Sewell,
yes,
who was a good friend of his, I think, both at the Royal College.
Yeah.
And the impression I get is that Lacey is more of a performer than actual filmmaker. And so he quickly falls into that role of being who possibly controls the film by his presence and by what he does and how he performs and so on. But it's an intriguing film, not least of which it you can see Islington in 1951. You see these sort of like ruined streets and lots of shop fronts.
Yeah.
There's emphasis on shop fronts and graffiti, not graffiti, well, you know, walls where posters have been torn off John Sewell died quite early, I think. He was the director of these first few films.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think he died in the sort of mid to late 70s. I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, you're right, what you've just said, but also there is I think there's a title that says Film By.
It's Mark Films.
Yeah, Mark Films. Yeah. And it's Bruce Lacey, John Sewell, Edward Dix, and a couple of other people.
Yeah.
And there's a sense that it's a group effort. But then perhaps the particular roles have been assigned to different people as part of the production. Yeah, but you're right, there is the sense of his character being firmly sort of impressed or printed on the film.
Yeah. I mean, did he actually direct any of the early films, or was he always just a participant?
Well, the follow-up, A Gibbon, A Gab from 53, he's credited with art direction. So right. I think there would have, a lot of the objects and costumes and things he would have been involved with.
That's a very odd film.
It is quite an odd film. And I've sort of compared it to sort of to Jack, a sort of English Jack Smith, Smith, a straight English
well,
Jack Smith.
But it's about 10 years before.
Yeah, yeah. So it's based on one of the stories of the Arabian Nights. And it's shot in Muswell Hill. Not you would be able to recognise or tell that. And it's some old prisoner of war structure from the First World War. And it's basically just this very sparse, empty concrete kind of shell with steps and different platforms, but all around it there's trees and leaves and bushes, and so it look. I mean, it doesn't really look like a temple, but it's hard to place where it is
more
and
like
what
a sort
it
of
is.
Bazaar, like an Arab bazaar.
Yeah.
But it's done in that. It's a bit. It's terribly uncompromising in its in as much as you can't imagine where it would have been placed at the time. It looks sort of like an art school film, but it's shot. Was he at the Royal College then, I suppose?
Yeah, because, I mean, he was at Hornsey then. We've been talking about the Royal College the whole time, which is my fault. But he was at Hornsey, and then he was at Royal College. And I think, actually, Head and Shadow was made when he was at Hornsey, but A Gibbon, A Gab would have been when he was at the Royal College.
Right.
It's interesting because, you know, prior to this thing being called underground film or whatever terms we might want to use, there was the amateur film scene. And, you know, he and his friends were part of that. So Head in Shadow won one of what was called the 10 best. So amateur, I'm getting some of my facts, amateur Cineworld had a yearly competition. And the 10 best got shown at the NFT and then were even distributed around the country.
So it did get some distribution.
So both films won the awards in their individual years.
Oh, okay.
So, but it's interesting. I mean, other people like Peter Watkins was also part of that kind of amateur scene in the 50s and 60s. So was Kevin Brownlow, Ken Russell, John Schlesinger. It's quite an interesting fertile time. And Duncan Riki's written quite a lot about it in his book.
Exploding Cinema.
The Definitive History of Underground Film, Subversion.
Right.
And it's a really great chapter. He talks about it all.
Right.
And it's, anyway.
Yeah.
Did I answer your question?
I can't remember now. It doesn't really matter.
No.
So the amateur, he got... Well, it's to do with distribution and uncompromisingness.
Yes.
I suppose he did, unlike, I suppose, many people... Well, he did make inroads into the commercial world, I suppose, via his connections with people like Spike Milligan and Michael Benti.
Yes.
I mean, there is this sort of thread of what you might call English absurdism or English surrealism.
Yeah.
But with the, what's it called, that film? A Gibbon, A Gab or something?
A Gibbon, A Gab.
Right.
Yeah.
I watched it this morning for the first time.
Right.
On the DVD. And it sort of struck me that the difference between him and, say, Spike Milligan is that, of course, there is almost a strange lack of humour about them, to me.
No, that's interesting.
You don't really laugh at... It's almost like he doesn't care. There was this element of trying to... He called it playing silly buggers. And also creating... I think there was one show called British Rubbish.
Yes.
And so it is almost as though he didn't care that it wasn't hitting that mark, as it were, because if it had hit the mark in the way that Spike Milligan did, it would have been far more commercial. It doesn't get belly laughs. You kind of watch it and you think, well, it's almost like comedy that hasn't quite worked or something.
Well, I sort of think with A Gibbon, A Gab, I think maybe the intention behind it is that it's a serious... sort of artistic production at some level. I mean, within the confines of what they're working. I mean, maybe that seems...
It's a bit like pantomime, isn't it?
Bruce would have to talk about this and what his intent was behind it. I mean, I think even in things that are moderately serious that he's been involved with, I think he can't help but play up and kind of goof around, for lack of a better word or better phrase. And I think he likes to subvert expectations as well. So he almost wants to subvert whether something might even be considered comedy, I think, traditional sense of trying to keep you on your edge.
It's like he's constantly trying to make a virtue out of the failure in a way.
Yeah.
Like he talked, there's one film where they sink into the mud or something.
Yes, and, yeah. And it's the Battle of New Orleans is a Bob Godfrey film that was made as a what would now be considered a pop video or pop promo right. for a Lonnie Donegan song, the Battle of New Orleans.
Right.
That's shot on a hand wound camera and it's kind of under crank, so you get this old timey kind of look to it, and it's sort of slapstick. Style yes. humor, and they're pretending to play instruments out in the marshes, and
slowly going to a fight and start sinking into the mud, start flowing mud.
And
and
he's unusually deadpan in that. That's one of the few times when Bruce is actually deadpan, because he usually is sort of gooning and guffawing and sort of gurning. And
then there's the other one by Harrison Marx, which is a 3-minute film.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is total chaos.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it even says at the beginning, Harrison Marx disowns this film.
Because it is
sort of totally shambolic. It's almost like everything is falling.
You'd think it would be part of the script, and yet it actually really does feel like chaos. So they just pushed it much further than probably someone else might have done in that situation.
Yeah. I was trying to think where this would come from in a way, and I was sort of backtracking to I could only come up with things like apparently Tommy Handley in the war, because he was in the war, wasn't he, Bruce Lacy?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And Tommy Handley was apparently very popular with the ITMAR programs.
Right.
It's That Man Again,
right,
which I possibly influenced people like Spike Milligan. You know, maybe after the war, there was this a mood amongst certain people just to create nonsense and absurdity.
Yeah, I think it's a sort of English version of nihilism. I mean, I talked about the Vienna Actionists, and I strangely think there is a sort of connection, a sort of cross current. I mean, I know that Bruce would not like us talking about the fact that he might have been inspired by someone else, or there might have been connection with something before him. And I think, which everyone is at some level, of course.
It doesn't come out of nothing.
But no. I do think, I mean, having read around the period, I do think that even within in the UK, people who've been in the war and national service, there does seem to be a number of people who are working different ways who express some kind of nihilistic absurdity, or there's like a sensibility that comes out of the alienation of being in war and in national service, I think, at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a 1,000-page Peter Sellers biography called The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, and the writer of that strangely makes connections between the goons and is it Adrian Searle, the illustrator who did the Trinians?
It's Ronald Searle.
Ronald Searle.
Yeah, yeah.
And his illustrator, Trinians and things, and how even like the quality of the line of his drawings being having him making some connections with the. Which is quite a reach, but it's.
Yes. Well,
this kind of acerbic, sharp, ridiculous quality being in these illustrations, and him having a. Also coming from this background and this kind of sense of excess in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to read the page to be convinced, I think, or even approach being convinced. But
right. And then there was musically, he had a connection with this outfit called the Alberts.
Yes.
Who were a kind of pre-Temperance Seven kind of, what were they, Edwardian type?
Sort of cod Edwardian pranksters.
Yes.
Who I think, like all the things we've just been talking about, they could play a number of different instruments, but intentionally played them very badly, and things sort of go wrong, and there'd be a strong sort of performative element. I mean, if you saw them walking around the East End of London now, and they were young men, you'd think they were hipsters in their prime, because they had big waxed moustaches and beards and sort of Victorian clothing.
But again, it's interesting because you say that thing about it going wrong, because that's the point, isn't it? It's almost like the difference between the Alberts and the Temperance Seven is that they had a hit with I can't remember what it was now, but they became very popular for doing that, and they could play on Top of the Pops or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And the same with Bruce Lacy, he would probably make a film, but unlike Spike Milligan, It wouldn't have that.
Well, maybe it's worse than this. Worth saying at this point is that you mentioned earlier the British Rubbish show, which was at the Establishment Club that Peter Cook ran.
Right.
it was, when was it, 64, I think. And it was, anyway, it was a, yeah. it was a really a hit show. It was like, it ran for ages, was extremely popular, and got written about in the press a lot. And in some ways, that's kind of where Priestley's career begins, in terms of people really knowing who he is and being recognised and being in the press. And subsequently, they recorded some of the sketches and songs for it for EMI, and George Martin produced the sessions.
Okay.
And they were going to put a record out, and John Saul, who we've mentioned already, was going to design the cover, because he was a graphic designer at that point and doing Penguin book covers and things. And it was basically a Union Jack flag with kind of in tatters and with sort of graffiti on it, and of in this decrepit state, a sort of a proto Sex Pistols.
Absolutely. Kind
of. And the chairman of EMI just refused that this to allow this record out that would have, you know, the Union Jack not, you know, well presented and looking pristine. And so, and then Bruce Lacy refused to compromise, so the record didn't come out. So whether they would have had a hit or not is another matter, but it's, you know, you might say, you know, was he resistant to success at some level? I don't know. I mean, I think it's interesting what you're saying about the chaos. There's some element of chaos, and not necessarily having that hit tune or that kind of definable hit quality, which then led to the next stages that other people had.
Because, of course, his art wouldn't, you can't imagine it being absorbed into the museum or gallery system at the time as such. It would always be outside, wouldn't it?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, he had a show at Gallery One, which was which, my understanding is, that was actually really quite a hip underground gallery. Right. And a lot of the Fluxus artists had shows there. So I think Yoko Ono possibly had a show there. I mean,
There's Yves Klein.
Right.
He was there, and also Ben Vautier, who sort of camped out in the window of the gallery for quite a long time.
Okay.
And so there was a lot, that was a gallery where it was a sort of focal point for this chaos, making art out of junk, totally uncompromising, sort of poking the eye of accepted aesthetics and so on. I suppose it's tricky.
I don't know whether he sold much work at that point, but there was, I mean, he was making, as part of the shows that he did with the Alberts, he was making robots and these kind of constructions that would be part of the show. And I think because of his background in military service, he had sort of certain electrical skills, and then combined with his art school experiences, made these structures. And at some point, I don't know if it was maybe Victor Musgrave, perhaps, or he who sort of made this connection, what he was doing with people like the Fluxus artists and other artists at the time. And I think it was called Proto Dada, that'd be the wrong, Neo Dada. There was someone, you know, there was some sense of trying to bring him back into an art context.
Yes, indeed.
Anyway.
Vaguely, I can't quite remember now. There's some connection with Throbbing Gristle somehow. Was it one of his sons or something?
Yeah, some more family connection sort. So in the 70s, Bruce Lacy was caretaker of Space Studios in London Fields. And that's where what also was known as the Death Factory, when Throbbing Gristle, Coombe, and then Throbbing Gristle were based there.
Right.
And I think one of Bruce Lacy's sons, who's actually John Lacy, I think his name is, actually a performance artist as well. He became friends, there must be some other link in here, but with Chris Carter of Throbbing Gristle, and they're both quite young. I think, I don't know, anyway, so somehow there was the kind of building connecting them, and then there was a friendship as well. I think it's interesting, if you look at Bruce's work, and that, you know, you hear this, some of the music and some of the environment constructions that he was doing with Jill Bruce. I mean, there's the journey through a black hole to a coloured planet, and there's it's flashing lights and sirens, and then sort of blackness. I mean, it's almost like a family version of Throbbing Gristle in some ways.
Right. Yeah. Okay, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and this week's guest is William Fowler, the British Film Institute curator for artist film since 2005.
Yes, I think that's right.
Okay, we should, let's give a quick, what should we say, promotion for the, there's the BFI DVD, which only cost £10.99 for two DVDs, called The Lacey Rituals. And that's reduced, isn't it? It used to be over £20, I think.
And it probably depends where you try and buy it.
Well, I bought it in the NFT, and they sort of...
Okay, that's good.
I asked for discount, and they said, no, you can't have discount, because it's only £10.99 already. But the CD has just come out, the Spacey Bruce Lacey Film Music and Improvisations, which I suppose we should get round to playing a track from eventually. But your own activities... William, you've got something coming up at the Horse Hospital, I think.
Yeah, that's correct. So on...
Remind me what that is.
Friday the 21st of November, I shall be playing in a improv trio called The Begotten. My fellow members being Mark Pilkington of Strange Attractor Press and Justin Harries of Film Bar 70.
Right.
And we'll be playing along to a film called Begotten, directed by Elias Merhige. I think that's how you pronounce his surname.
Right.
And some people may know him from later directing Shadow of the Vampire, which is the sort of making of Nosferatu, the sort of fictionalised making of Nosferatu. And this was an earlier film that he made, which it sort of represents the birth of this, I think, the sort of son of man and the mother and Mother Earth kind of appearing in a sort of desolate landscape and then being set upon by, I don't know, robed thugs, I suppose, for lack of a better...
Sounds a bit like a Lacey Ritual.
Well, it does. Actually, to be honest with you, it's a good point. It would play very well with exactly. Given a gap. And it's strange. Right. It's much darker in tone. It's quite violent and bloody.
Made?
And
when
it's shot on 16mm, black and white. And it's been... I don't know whether... He says that he distressed the image. It looks as though maybe he reprinted it several times. So it has a... It's kind of got quite a rough edge to it and high contrast image, but it's from 1990.
Oh, okay.
Susan Sontag was a big fan, apparently, of this film.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're playing at the... When is this?
So there's a Horse Hospital week on Friday, week today, in fact.
I've got to do some preparation. It's the 21st, at the Horse Hospital.
Yeah.
It's you improvising on you. What did you play, guitar and...
Tapes and sort of process-based guitar.
Right.
And some other objects.
Right, okay. Well, let's play a track from the Spacey Bruce Lacey. This is track 9. It's just called Experiment 1.
Thank you. boom, 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 boom.
Well, that track was called Experiment One, and that's from the Spacey Bruce Lacey Film Music and Improvisations, released quite recently, isn't it, William?
Yeah, I think a matter of weeks ago, I think the end of October, so very recent.
And there are two vinyl LPs as well. Do they have bonus tracks or something, or what's the difference? Is there any difference, or is it just because they're on vinyl?
It's a good question. I think the main difference is they're just on vinyl.
Just on vinyl, but it's in two volumes, so you have to probably pay about 40.
I think most people just want to buy vinyl now, so I think it seems to be the way. We either download things or you buy vinyl, you know, go for the object in its larger sense.
So we were just, whilst that track was playing, I sort of asked you the fairly crass question of, like, how on earth did he earn a living over the last 50 years, or whatever it is? Because the art is so uncompromising and doesn't
in a non-traditional way.
Well, there is no merchandise to speak of, or unless he's sold the odd robot or something, I suppose.
He did sell some of his robots, so I mean, it's interesting that the Tate did they did a show around the 60s, I think they just called it the 60s, whenever that was, about 10, 15 years ago.
Right.
And his piece, The Womanizer, they bought the piece afterwards.
Right.
Okay. And the Tate owned at least two, if not more, pieces him. And so, I guess some other collections do around the country. So I mean, he started out as a painter, and then he returned to painting when he entered his sort of earth rituals phase. He started to do sort of kind of cosmic paintings, I suppose you'd call them, on natural canvases and things.
And then he appeared as wasn't he a gardener in the Help film by the Beatles?
Yeah, he's
film.
Paul McCartney's gardener.
Right.
So he has an indoor lawn, which Bruce Lacey mows with some chattering, wind-up teeth.
Right.
Okay. So he was, I think, I spoke to Richard Lester, who, of course, directed the Beatles films, and he was really fond of Bruce Lacey and also Bob Godfrey and a few other people who he just thought were great characters.
Right.
And even if he was making larger budget films, he just thought those people should be in films and people should see them. So, I mean, I think probably the time he got Superman, he probably wasn't thinking about Bruce Lacey so much.
No.
But in the early days, I think he was keen to. And he, of course, he is in the Running Jumping Still film, although he's sort of uncredited.
Oh, isn't he?
I'm saying that. I know he's not credited with sort of having a creative input, which I think is a bone of contention for Bruce, even though he does do like a little... He has two scenes in the film.
Right. And that's Richard Lester as well.
Anyway, that was directed by Richard Lester. So Richard Lester had a long term... And he bought one of Bruce's paintings, I understand it. So.
I suppose he helped Michael Bentine with It's a Square World, didn't he, making the props and so on,
Which
might have produced some income at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think he was... probably doing the British Rubbish Show would have produced... He would have earned a living from that. And then because of his... interest in objects and collections and things, I think he got introduced to the BBC and was making props for various shows.
Okay.
So he had worked with the BBC. Right. He was on It's a Square World.
Yeah. And you were telling me about...
And I guess he was the caretaker. Jumping ahead a bit, he was the living caretaker at the Space Studios. I imagine he's earned, to survive and earn a living. He's done different things at different times.
And he's now living in Norfolk.
Yeah, he's lived in Norfolk since the early 80s in a sort of farmhouse.
He sort of takes part in these kind of like rituals, but of a different ilk these days. It's a sort of like... What do you call those events that take place in villages with Morris dancers almost?
Fates and fairs.
Fates and fairs, exactly.
Yeah.
He contributes to those sometimes?
Yeah. I mean, it's always an interesting thing is that, he's still... is creative and doing performances and things, even if it's just locally. So, yeah. And I think, you know, you see him in the Jeremy Deller and Nick Abrahams film, The Lacey, what's it called? The Bruce Lacey Experience.
Okay.
You see him performing, basically going to sleep on a sort of portable mattress with flowers around him and things.
Right.
And he ends up holding up the traffic, and it's a bit of a
yes.
chaos ensues, as it predictably
always
does
chaos.
In Word. Yeah.
Yes, yes. But
he says that he does these things kind of out of love of the area where he lives, but also to slightly take the piss. Like, it's sort okay. of that double-edged thing, which I think is very much the Bruce Lacey way.
And what's this Fairport Convention connection?
Yeah, so I think when he lived in Notting Hill at one point, and he was neighbours with Ashley Hutchings of Fairport Convention, and he wrote a song about him called Mr. Lacey, which includes the sounds of Bruce Lacey's robots in the middle eight, I believe.
Oh,
there's
wow.
a robot instrumental break.
Oh, I should have tried to get
I know,
that.
I should have thought to suggest it, but they did it at Cropperty, the Fairport Convention annual festival, and they had Bruce on stage with his robots.
Oh, really?
This is about 10 years ago or
okay.
something. So,
All right. Well, maybe we should, we could sort of just
one thing I was going to say, we were asking about other, we were talking about what else to chat about, and it's interesting thinking about, I mean, Johnny Chunk talks about this in his notes in the on the CD and vinyl releases, but actually how Bruce made his music is kind of interesting, perhaps.
Absolutely.
So in his DIY style, amateur style, if you like, the music was made with a kit that he bought from Exchange and Mart magazine, and the seller, so a schoolboy had made a synth using a kit that he'd learned about in Practical Electronics magazine, to be really specific, and then Bruce had bought it from Exchange and Mart, so he'd kind of and then he had bought another piece of kit again from another schoolboy, so he just quite low-key basic gear, which he then bought and recorded at home sort of played around with. So
yeah, and so most of the tracks on this CD are of that ilk,
yes.
sort of what one would call sort of lo-fi.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and I've been talking to William Fowler about Bruce Lacey. And I suppose we could just play out with one of the tracks. I've circled something called Cycles of the Serpent 3.
Mm.
Does that meet with your approval?
Does.
Does that seem okay? Do you have any favourites on here?
Kissing Film is good, I think.
Well, we started.
Which we started with, so that's good.
Okay. Well, this is Cycle Serpent 3.
Thank you. Thank you.